Good afternoon, world. Welcome to another episode of the IP Breakfast with attorneys Albert Dicady and Emmanuel Coffey. To start, we'll start with our usual disclaimer that our opinion in this episode is ours and does not impart on any of our employers. So today we are actually going to have a guest as well who will come and join us in a little bit later. His name is Anthony Whittington. Counsel, good afternoon.
Well, good afternoon, counsel, and good morning, good afternoon, depending on the time that you spend listening to us. We hope that you'll enjoy today's episode and welcome our guests.
So I will, we have to tell our audience why we have, instead of an IP breakfast, having an afternoon session. It is because our guest today is from the West Coast. So we had to allow time for him to join us while he may be, he could be having brunch.
Not breakfast, eh?
Not breakfast. So, We have sometimes we're gonna have to change the time just so we can accommodate our guests and bring a bigger and improve the breadth of discussion for our attorneys and for our audience. And sometime we might have somebody on an international or a different zone, we'll work with that. So, counsel, quickly, give the audience a little bit of breath of what we're going to discuss today by view of a summary of what we have kind of done so far with the different sessions. Not a complete detail, but, you know, we've spoken about every aspect of intellectual property, and now the programs will really be focusing not on one, but on all.
Right. We... the last, by way of background, the last of the intellectual property that we spoke about was trade secret, I'm sorry. And then we went over the different aspects of trade secret, and also spoke a little bit about Defend Trade Secret Act, which makes a trade secret, which provides a claim, a cause of action, a federal cause of action for trade secret. And we also started to discuss diversity in IP, and we didn't have much time, we didn't say much about that, and I believe our guests will touch on that more, right?
So so one of the things that we want to highlight, and there was an article that you, counsel, made me aware of in talking about the number of the percentage that African-American attorneys represent to the bar, IP attorneys. And it was astounding to find out that only 1.7% of attorneys in the United States that practice IP are some kind of minority. There's a big gap there that we will certainly keep diving into. We'll dive in that subject matter with our guests today, and also with future guests, in a hope that we can kind of find what are the symptoms, what is causing that problem, and perhaps also propose solutions to trying to bridge the gap. Our guest today is a young man that I have known for a while, very cultivated, very well educated, well rounded in IP, and this is why we actually invited him today. A gentleman that I admire, and seeing his path in intellectual property and beyond, which he will get into with you guys today. So my guest actually has arrived, Council. So I want to introduce you to Anthony Whittington. And Anthony, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Albert. Thank you, Emmanuel.
Good afternoon and welcome, Anthony.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Emmanuel. So just to piggyback off some of the statements, just to give a little bit of introduction about myself. My name is Anthony Whittington. I'm a co-founder and CEO of a software technology and business advisory services company. Basically the name of the organization is called QC. We have a series of technology solutions and advisory services that we're offering. Chimera is our coming release of a very innovative marketplace solution to be able to facilitate our advisory services as well as offer a cost-effective way for business owners to sell their products and services. In light of this discussion, my background, by way, as Albert mentioned, intellectual property is part of the lens of services we offer. Ultimately, as a perspective, as Albert has said, traditionally, the notion of intellectual property is this notion of, I'm sure that Emmanuel and Albert have discussed numerous times, of the traditional categories of patents, trademarks, and copyrights. And I think that is a very, very easy way to describe what intellectual property is. But as a practical matter, I mean, it is part important strategy and lens for all entrepreneurs, business owners. And I think from an economic standpoint, it comes as a perspective of a competitive advantage. So in business in general, as we do for a lot of our companies that we advise and that we service, the notion is that they're always looking for some way in the marketplace, no matter what the industry, no matter what their market segment, no matter what their positioning is to have some competitive advantage. And traditionally, intellectual property has been the means. So when you look at a business, I mean, their objective is ultimately to, for all practical purposes, sell a product or a service, be able to meet some need in the marketplace. And as we look at the history of intellectual property and how the various organizations, such as the United States Patent and Trademark Office, has been involved since its inception, has been rewarding inventive concepts some type of property right, which gives them the right to exclude others. And I think that Emmanuel and Albert has done a great job of kind of highlighting that. But when we look at it in that lens, we only see, I guess, part of what that perspective is. If you look at it from large companies or small organizations or early stage companies, a lot of it is geared towards they have some R&D as being an engineer, a consultant, a JD, an MBA, and as was a, and always will be, a IP practitioner. In that context, you start to wonder to yourself, and I think that most business owners, definitely big companies, from small to entrepreneurs, is return on investment. I'm sure Albert and Emmanuel can speak to what the costs were to prosecute a patent and any other intellectual property right that's deemed necessary. But I think the larger perspective is that people look at it from as an investment, right? You don't know what kind of adequate protection. You know, there's a business risk. You're hoping for achieving some type of reward. There's a sense of utility. And as a function of this, a big part of this is actual access to capital and how much you have to finance this. And I think this is one of the topics that we say about at least the representation from at least the standpoint of minorities and women in the intellectual property field. But in general, I mean, it's the STEM representation, right? It's always about these big budgets in terms of the resources that are being allocated and who are the most adequate practitioners, professionals to work about that. One of the interesting things, and I will highlight this about the monetization and the licensing aspects of intellectual property, there's a lot of those individuals are not attorneys. A lot of them are business executives, which I'm more in that role, at least on the strategy side with my organization. Even I'm also, I'm a member of the patent bar and a practitioner, but I think that is really the direction where things are going. And maybe that's a function of the legal industry as itself, that the perspective is more of a commoditization that's been done by the number of entrants in the market, either at the big law level or at the, you know, individual solo practitioners to the, you know, middle tier firms. I think that's driving the dialogue and the discussion. And as we already know, this is a matter of statistics, you start looking at those numbers, there's going to be a correlation towards women and minorities, which is a reflection of corporate America, which the legal field and other areas are a reflection of that directly. So the dialogue begins with the access to resources, which is a function of intellectual property, and the ability to regulate or manage those resources is a function of your competitive advantage. And I, like I said, as I started the discussion, in the competitive advantage is really the key element, right? A lot of organizations will, and most companies do, have probably a heavy trademark portfolio, and other intellectual property rights, copyrights, and other things that are proprietary that fall into the intellectual property, such as trade secrets and other confidential information, steps, processes that don't meet what we would think of the traditional forms of intellectual property. And then we start getting into, obviously, publicity and rights of privacy and all these other things that are property rights in themselves, but kind of go into that blurry area of the space. But that being the case, if you look at it from patent holders, I'm sure Albert can speak to this, and Emmanuel, you probably speak to this. If you look at certain companies, certain tech companies, their R&D budgets obviously are geared towards securing some type of rights and protections along their patent portfolio. But if you think about from small business owners and a lot of mid-sized companies, I mean, they're not, you know, they're not having extensive patent portfolios. It's really certain industries and certain incumbents that seem to be the bulk of where all that value is being created. And obviously, they're obviously directed towards that is the amount of economic revenues that are generated off of fees to the patent office, as well as to practitioners and other third-party organizations that are facilitating the matriculation of those rights and obviously the maintenance.
Great. Anthony, let me ask you if you could talk to the audience about antitrust as in relationship to competitive advantage.
Antitrust?
Yes.
Yeah. So right now, it's interesting that you said that, and we have a lot of talks of antitrust violations, and there's different metrics in place in that context. You know, we say antitrust and IP, although those things are kind of often, you know, placed in similar spaces, they're very different, right? Antitrust is obviously a situation where there is a certain organization that through whatever means has acquired a certain market share or has certain influences. And usually the scenarios that we think about for antitrust, I guess, in some of the typical case book scenarios, or somebody, you know, committing some form of predatory pricing, and they are doing something that would be deemed unethical or unfair to put competitors out of place. The best example I can think of, and probably is more relevant to this time, is Amazon. That's the modern example, right? Although they did not do anything that would be traditional indicators of antitrust, like the days of shale oil and the Sherman Act and the case law that makes that determination, and the DOJ is one of the organizations that help force that, they themselves are in a position where they did engage in predatory pricing. You say, well, how did they engage in predatory pricing exactly? Well, what did they do? They priced at essentially marginal cost or below marginal cost, where they use AWS, their cash cow, which is for all the readers, or obviously your listeners who don't know what AWS, obviously it is a set of IT or other, I would say, data services for organizations to be able to host data and have servers and redundancy and backup and other solutions for the IT functions of a lot of companies, a lot of early stage companies. They use the revenue for that to offset their inability to make money through their marketplace, and they undercut their individuals. Now, that was the basis of the so-called predatory pricing. And as we already found out, the DOJ started the investigation on that. They started going further and further investigation. They realized they were manipulating things with their customers' supply chains, and they were also engaging into other things that might not deem feasible for those business owners that were on their site. So the notion of antitrust is traditionally you're doing something in the marketplace that is, you know, deemed unethical or unfair in a business sense, and there's different findings of it. Usually the indications on textbook antitrust is when obviously organizations start to merge, and as they start to merge, more market share is kind of covered, and that usually raises flags. And like I said, you can go through the book about what they look at, about what meets on its face. But as we see in these other organizations, in the Amazons and these other internet companies, that they are obviously, they're skating around with the traditional definition of antitrust. And it's obviously much more involved than just a simple test.
So Anthony, you know, in when we look at the gap and the disparity that exists, you know, among the demographics and you know, women, African American, veterans, and you know, compared to the big boxes that tend to always that have a budget, like you mentioned, to actually acquire intellectual property. That intellectual property, and then being able to market that intellectual property, whether it actually produce the product or licensing or any way of doing monetization of that of their IP, and in all respect, whether it is patent, whether it's trademark, copyrights, and so on. So where do you see the issues more that creates that scenario for the demographics? Is it the lack of information, a lack of cost, and for education, I would say, you know, lack of information, education about the subject matter? Because I'm still baffled that, you know, people who do not know the word intellectual property, they don't even know the basics of it at all. Or is it capital? Which I think you mentioned capital before, but can you explain more?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think the traditional vehicles for procuring intellectual property rights are not effective in a lot of communities. I mean, the notion of what the stereotypical patent attorney or IP attorney has changed since, I would say, probably the 80s. In the 90s to, you know, the acquisition of a lot of boutiques at law firms. And what has happened is there's a lot of IP professionals who are not lawyers. I mean, obviously in the patent context, patent agent is not a lawyer, and you start seeing that there's segmentation. The concern around is that what is the purpose of intellectual property? I mean, if you're at a large company, and this is true, and I recommend this through our advisory services for small business owners. I mean, large to anywhere from small to medium size, you shouldn't be going to court, right? I mean, obviously there's vehicles like IPRs and stuff that are way more cost effective and, you know, an advisory service, but that's not worth small to mid-sized people's time. And the biggest return, I mean, trademarks are actually probably the most viable option for, you know, universally across the board, all business owners. It's a factor for goodwill when people are doing acquisitions and purchases of LLCs or S-Corps, a lot of small businesses. It's a factor when companies merge. It gives you pricing power when you're at different sales channels and stuff. But patents, I mean, like I said, it's only a certain sector of organizations that have the cash to enforce those rights. I mean, most the reality is from a monetization, and we've talked and engaged companies. We're engaged companies right now for some of our small business owners' assets right now. When you go approach a organization that's outside a certain sophistication level, and we just talk about it in terms of market cap, right? I would say, you know, you probably, you know, there's probably a certain comfort level. They're $100 million or above in market cap, and that's like peons compared to when you think about Apple's worth $1 trillion market cap, right? But I mean, you see that you look at the scale, there is definitely a knowledge gap of what the reality. Most people, most business owners, if it's not outside their core business, I mean, what actually, you know, pays the bills and pays their salaries, they're not going to care about it, right? It's not until they have pain points. And unfortunately, most legal discussions are very contentious. I mean, that's just the nature. You get a cease and desist letter, or you have a discussion. That's not facilitating negotiations. Where in business, at a higher level tier, these higher level market caps, these large organizations, they're licensing deals left and right. people are cross-selling, people are not dealing with those things. And the trend, obviously, there's been a shift with that because of the market conditions that we deal with. Even before COVID-19, there's other alternatives and resources in terms they want to assert something. But if you look at that, if you were to go through and pull all the data, and there's a lot of different data sources, you would see it's a very different dialogue at that stage, those larger deals, and that's where all the lawsuits are happening. So when you go on and you talk to a person outside that tier or the engineer that works at a, if you're talking about in terms of a Facebook, which is very different than, in my opinion, than like AMD, you know, they got, you know, they're different incentives. You know, you look at the murkiness of software patents and all the variations and different courts reliability, but the incentives are not no different from those people. They're getting, you know, whatever $100 or maybe it's $1,000, depending on what their budget is for that R&D budget, to encourage people to foster IDs. Then you're trying to look at, well, what's the expected return and value? Is this something that's just part of a larger portfolio for features that may or may not be used? You're not monetizing a lot of those things. The dialogue's very different. So on a per asset level, it's, and I talk about a piece of intellectual property, in this context of patent, you're not really moving the needle. If you're talking about a portfolio where someone's going through a distress situation and a company goes there and buys out looking for nuggets of gold, that's probably more realistic in large companies and mid-sized companies, because they know they're getting it at a discounted price. They don't care about what turns out, not turn out, right? Because, you know, before IPRs, you know, minimum you're spending $250,000 to be able to defend. You know, that's just going through legal fees and everything else. You're not seeing a return. So I say that because contextually it matters, right? Whether it's capital is always a function. Small and mid-sized companies don't want to spend it, but big companies, they have budgets and they don't want to spend either. They can spend it on something else. And then it's the other point about the educational channels. I'm spending this money for an asset, you know, trademark I can see because I have a nice slogan that someone wants to protect, and that's what people associate, and that's how I differentiate, that's how I demand a higher price point. But for a patent, what is this? I don't know what this is gonna do. Do I even meet the criteria of a patent? Yeah, design patents are obviously enforceable. I think 2019 and 2018 were good years. But how many people get to that point? The dialogue starts to drop off very so. So if you're talking about large companies where all the litigation and all the fees going on, then you're also talking about the monopolies that I think that you all were talking about earlier, with the same, you know, ivory tower organizations that are, their representation speaks all. They're usually traditionally older white men. There's a few minorities, maybe an Asian, maybe African American, maybe Hispanic, depending on what part of the community you are, and a few women. But generally speaking, it's generally older white men that run and manage. And IP is still a pet project, you know, that they deal with. And the IP people are weird and strange. And traditionally, the trademark attorneys, if they don't allow for both, they're usually, you know, English majors, a lot of them, and they went to extremely Ivy League schools, and they think that their fluff is any different than any other person that worked as a practitioner or not, and really doesn't, because every examiner has their own distinct ways. So I think that really changes the lens, and I think all the factors that you talked about definitely drive it. Like I said, one of the things I think we need to emphasize is that the educational piece is an important piece. It's a function, as you already described, resources, which is a function of capital. I don't even know I'm gonna sell this unit. Why am I gonna protect it? In a unit, I'm saying very generically, versus how do I maintain to scale? And that's another factor. Maybe you just have a business that someone can invest into, and maybe it's not. Maybe it's just you sell a bunch of widgets during a short season, you get some cash, you move on to the next venture, or it's just a hobby. That's where I think those are the barriers. And then you look at the representation factor of men and women in those large organizations. They're not going to go for small to mid-sized guys typically, because there's no cash there, right? And that's driving these decisions. They either, why am I going to risk a conflict or a well-known client that has a huge R&D budget, where, you know, if they got, you know, $80 million and you're getting the 0.5% of that in legal fees, you're happy. You get two of those, you might have an okay life. You're working at least 100 hours, but you're okay, you know? And I think that's what the equation is. But.
Yeah, Anthony, so I know Coffee may have some question during time is going fast. But I want to talk to the small inventor now. It seems like what we just said kind of goes against the small inventor, the guy who's in his garage right now, who's working on something. But every now and then you have, like, you know, the case of the wiper case, or Lenny Johnson, for example, with the water gun.
Super soccer, but
which became extremely successful. So what can you say to these small inventors? And Council, I'll leave the last question.
Yeah, of course. And if Emmanuel, if you want to speak before that, I want you to take a shot. I can speak to that, because I actually talk about those two scenarios all the time.
No, go ahead. I think time is flying. I'll chime in if I need to.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I don't want to go on tangents, but I want to kind of. So the Lonnie Johnsons of the world. So I look at the Lonnie Johnson scenario as actually a scenario I talk about, not just in the intellectual property context, but the whole thing about the bargaining power. Lonnie Johnson, for a lot of people who don't know, he was the inventor of the Super Soaker. Super, super gifted, talented person. Happened to be an African-American gentleman. I think he went to I could be wrong, but I think it was a couple of historically black colleges and universities, and got a master's, and I think he was maybe even aeronautical aerospace engineer. A brilliant guy. The relevance of this is, and this is not that far off, and I'll just make a little to the situation with the gentleman that was Famous Amos. This is the, you know, you got this the creatives of the world, right? These people are super brilliant, they have something, but they don't have bargaining power. And I think this goes to the point that you were talking about, because these guys need the bargaining power. Lonnie Johnson, you know, came up with this wonderful right. The organization at the time, I think Hasbro was the owner of the Super Soaker. I don't know if they were the originator. He basically gave them access. He's, you know, signed in the patent. And they monetized this through the roof. I mean, since 1991 or 93, I think it was 91, they made hundreds and hundreds of millions and millions of dollars. I mean, but that's not the number that I want you to think about. That's off of Super Soaker sales. We're not talking about all the derivatives of other modified Super Soakers. And I use Super Soakers, so I think they're pretty cool, fun things. My kids, whatever. So I think that's something that's really important and critical. But the thing about it is, all of the trademark brands, all that stuff, I mean, the valuation of the economic value that his one concept made, because I love the creative, the small business owners, is, I mean, it probably is easily, you know, probably $600-700 million easily. The relevance of this story that I think is really important is because if you read the rest of his story, he was devalued of, I think, of whatever that astronomical number was in terms of sales. He only got roughly 0.4% of all that revenue over 30 years. He spent a big part of that fighting through legal fees to have the ownership rights to have a larger piece of the pie. Now, I know you could say to me, and I think the gentleman, and I don't have the exact numbers, usually I have these numbers with me, you would say to me, well, you know, Anthony, he just got some money. I mean, he got 0.4%. He had to fight for his money. I think, and I don't know his age right now, but I think I last checked, he was around his 60s. I mean, he spent a good, I don't know, 10 plus years, and I quote me on the numbers, because this was a very unique case, fighting for his right to be able to assert his privilege because he didn't have good bargaining power with the big companies. And this goes to my whole point about protecting their interests. If he would have had education, definitely. But the question is, if someone would have made hundreds of millions of dollars and they were getting 0.4%, and I say that number is actually probably slightly less than that, because of lawyer fees, the inflation, delayed time it takes to get that, the effort and energy, him not getting the upside, that's a concern for all business owners, and it'd be a concern for any property rights owner. No one wants to be able to fight for something they're entitled to. I say that similarly in the context of the very famous case about the professor that was the windshield wiper case, the movie, Greg Kinnear's movie, Flash of Genius. Don't remember the gentleman's name, but I usually use a reference. Very similar situation. Once again, you know, the motor company, I think it was Ford, I don't want to misquote that, but I think it was Ford or one of those Detroit motor companies, fought him, and he spent all his money on fees trying to be able to get those property rights. And think about all the lost income and all the economic value that was captured by these third-party organizations, and not just off of that patented idea, all the derivatives and all the brands associated around that. that would generate off that concept. And I don't think people look at that. That valuation is extremely high. That's both the super soaker scenario and both the windshield wiper scenario. And very similar, you can throw in the famous Amos situation. And I say this because the relevance is that there's two prongs of this, and this is the economist speaking. There's the creation, value creation, which is the intellectual property process has helped to facilitate and protect that. And then there's the value capturing. Now, I know a lot of people will say, well, you know, the man made millions of dollars, he needed marketing, he needed promoting. If he would have had the right set of advisors and someone to assist him through that process and to talk about the business case, the intellectual property case, you know, the strategy with the corporate, the bargaining power that he has, having other market opportunities to be able to extract as much of that value that he created, I guarantee the scenario would have been differently. And that's why I think it's really important that all these individuals, whether it's Lonnie Johnson, whether it's famous Amos, whether it's the windshield wiper, who are all different people, different ages, different backgrounds, ethnicities, this is very significant that you said and you identified, Albert, it's a real problem. They are not getting the full picture of it. And this goes to the point for any people that say, oh, I just go and I get a patent, I'm gonna go to these companies. Bargaining power, the strategy and tactics, the services and seeing the whole picture is so important when you're a small business owner. Everyone's in this position that has to be worried about this. And this is something that we have to continually to fight and cultivate this culture of being well-rounded and versed on these opinions so you have the best upside. Because most people would not give up their birthright for a bowl of soup. If you choose to do that, that's great. But if you're well aware of the pros and cons, you're not going to do that. You're definitely not going to fight for what you something that you've created. And I think that's a big concern.
Emmanuel, I think our audience will not shoot us for extending a little bit today. So I do want you to ask the question. Hello, Emmanuel. Emmanuel, are you there? All right, I don't hear Emmanuel. So we are over time, but we do want to continue this conversation with different attorneys and maybe even bringing in a professional like Anthony who practices across the board to discuss this issue, because obviously we as a country cannot function or fire all cylinders if there are marginalized groups when it comes to being able to take advantage of the intellectual property system as equally with other groups and contribute. Obviously, we gave examples today where minorities are able to contribute, but the challenges, the hurdles in their way makes it a little bit difficult to actually be in this space, whether it is lack of information, capitalization, bargaining power, being able to use the court system to assert their rights. So all these things are hurdles that is inhibiting the country to actually fire on all cylinders, wherein all contributors can actually contribute. We want to thank our guest today, Anthony, for coming and giving us such a big breadth of expansion of thinking about different things.
Albert,
intellectual property.
Yeah, I found a statistic because I like to source. I'm very A-type in that regard. I want to throw this number out. This is sources, a bunch of sources compiled through, said that the Super Soaker debuted in 1991, starting with $200 million in sales, so far approaching sales of $1 billion as of in 2022 times. It said in November 2013, Johnson was awarded nearly $73 million in royalties from Hasbro Inc., and that's going through multiple rounds of arbitration and everything else. So, I mean, if you were looking at the numbers of, you know, he's getting $73 million. And that's once again, let's just simple math. You know, that percentage is very small. That's 7%, but it's less than that because of all the legal fees, the court costs, all the stuff that's being, taken away from that. you know, he's more like at, you know, getting 5%. They got $1 billion of revenue. And like I said, this is not including derivatives, brands, all the other promotional materials. This is just unit sales and the product. The economic value, that would be a complete failure. And this is that common thing that why in my organization, we're geared towards seeing it from all these different lens, the tools, techniques, and technologies that we're building, because this is so important, right? What you just said, the disparity is great. It's astronomically horrible. I mean, by the standards of if you were in Hollywood about what you spend on your budget and the returns and all the investors, you wouldn't do this deal. But continue, sir. I appreciate it.
Yes. So thank you, Anthony. We are over time. I don't hear Council Coffee. I'm going to call him again to see if he's there. Council Coffee, you want to have some input in? It seems like we lost him for some reason, although he does show connected to the system here. With that, and Anthony, on behalf of myself and Emmanuel, thank you for participating. We apologize to our audience for the extra 5 or 6 minutes that this program will be in. We usually stay within 30 minutes, and also apologize for late submission, because we usually submit on Saturday and it's usually a breakfast. But as we explained, this was to accommodate our guest who is in the West Coast, where we are in the East Coast. So please listen, enjoy, and let's see if together we can help at least give information about the hurdles and appeal to the proper authorities and the powers that be to actually mend the gap. What we are certain about is that if this economy is going to function on all cylinders, then all cylinders must have fuel. Thank you.
Agreed.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you. All right. Bye.
Bye, Anthony.